Hi, this is John Gorka, and you're listening to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, damn it. This is Rabbi Saul Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And I am so thrilled and so excited to be talking to the person who is laughing in the background there. He's got a marvelous laugh. His name is John Gorka. And it shouldn't surprise us that he laughs beautifully because he also sings beautifully and he writes wonderful songs. He's been recording since 1987. This makes him a veteran already. He has almost a dozen albums out. He's been on Austin City Limits. He's been on E-Town. He's been on CNN. But most importantly, he's on Dave's Gone By with us right now in the neighborhood. He's pushing his new album. It's called Bright Side Down. And this Thursday, March 27th, he's also going to be at Subculture, which is a new venue at 45 Bleecker, which, believe it or not, is located at 45 Bleecker Street. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just read this bit about John Gorka from the Huffington Post. What John Gorka does so well is transform the place he appears at. Before the show, there's a hushed excitement, and after, a sense of appreciation. His musical values are permanent, deeply human, and life-giving for the human spirit. End quote. Nobody has ever said anything like that about me.
I could say that about you.
All right, please say that about me. Did you memorize it while I was saying it?
What's that? I wish I had those words in front of me, then I would say them about them.
Well, that's most kind of you.
About you.
And we get the sense, there's a sense in all your music and in your performances that you are a genuinely nice guy. I know that's a kind of a fluffball question, but do you consider yourself a genuinely nice guy?
Well, that's something I seek but don't always achieve.
Oh, well, I'm a bastard about 23% of the time, so I totally get it. Now, let me ask most important question for, at least for me, ethnically. What is Gorka? Is that Polish? Where is that coming from, the derivation?
Yeah, Gorka is a Polish name. I'm not sure if that was the original, it might have gotten changed along the way. But it means, in Polish, it means small hill.
Small hill. So, for example, my ex-girlfriend has two Gorkas. I would hope not. Well, then again, half the people around the block knew her. But we're not going to talk about that right now. But you're not Jewish, are you?
I guess not that I know of. You know, it's possible there, on the Eastern European side, there may be some Jewish Gorkas, but I don't know that. I grew up as a Catholic.
As a Catholic. Now, there is something, I wouldn't necessarily say religious, or but certainly spiritual. You have one song about being on a cross or something, but are you at all religious now? Are you atheistic? Where do you lie now?
Right now, I'm kind of a lost sheep. I feel like the various religions have kind of, I'm kind of disappointed in...
Welcome to the club, yeah?
But other than that, you know, I think that there's more than what we see. And I'll kind of, as the Iris DeMint song goes, let the mystery be.
Let the mystery be. So do you then, in your life and in your work, have a certain moral compass or a certain... Because there is something that pulses through your songs that has... What? Tell me.
I think that's one of the things my favorite... I was a philosophy and history major in school, and one of my favorite class was ethics. So just, I think that that there is a hierarchy of values and that people should live their lives by. That's something I try to pay attention to and try to have some principles that I live by.
All right, this is good. And as you said, most of the time you succeed, you think?
I hope most of the time. I guess I'm not the one who, I'm kind of partial, so I'm probably not a good judge.
Well, I know who might be a good judge. You have a wife and two children.
Yes.
Mazel, Mitglick. How long have you been married?
I've been married since 96, so it's coming up on 18 years.
Chai years! 18 is chai in my people's thing.
Is that right?
I'll explain it another time. But this is wonderful, and you've got children, but, okay, you're a singer, a songwriter, you're a performer, you have to tour.
Yes.
How do you balance life as a performer going out there and having the responsibility of a husband and father?
Yeah, that's the difficult thing is to try to, because it's hard on my wife to be almost like a single parent a lot of the time since I'm away. I'm away so much, but I try not to go for long trips the way I used to before I was married. Now I go out for three or four shows at a time, then come back and then do that again for the next weekend, and then now I'm taking next weekend off, so I've got about 10 days at home, which is a very nice thing.
But it's not like you go away for 2 months to Japan.
No, I couldn't do that because you will become, people will learn to live without you if you're away for that long.
Ooh. Is your wife, she was working when you met her, is she still working? Is she now just,
Works as a freelance writer.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so she can work at home. You know, it's difficult. It's because of the kids' schedules and trying to keep everything going. That's difficult. But when the kids are in school, she can get some work done.
And over the summers, would you start, as they get a little older, traveling with the family? Or you don't think that's a life for them to be backstage at every concert, et cetera, and so forth?
I guess the way I travel right now, it probably wouldn't work out. But maybe I think there's a couple of possible places that if it works out that I'll be playing, that we'll probably try to make a vacation out of it.
Very nice. We're talking with John Gorka, and I'm gonna let's roll it back. Let's get back to you discovering that you could be a singer and songwriter. When was the first song you ever wrote?
I don't remember this. I think it was just a song about wondering if I could write a song. Sitting around on a Sunday afternoon with a guitar and wondering, could I write a song? I think that's probably what it was about. I'm pretty sure it's a pretty forgettable song.
But what age range are we talking about?
I guess 14 or 15.
Okay. So you already had a guitar at that point. You knew you wanted to be
right.
Musical. Your parents encouraged it?
I think they liked it. The first, I played viola in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. They had a Suzuki Method violin and viola. Then in junior high, probably 9th grade, I started, I got a banjo. And I wanted to learn bluegrass banjo. And about 6 months later, started playing the guitar.
Well, banjo is tough, isn't it? It's a very difficult. Can you still play the banjo?
I played a little bit, yeah. I still love the sound of the banjo, but I figured I would never be as good as I wanted it to be. It seemed like I started writing songs pretty much right away when I started playing guitar. I felt like that I was able to put more of myself into the writing of the songs and the playing of the songs than I could in the banjo instrumentals, but I still love the sound of the banjo.
Now, you go through high school, you go off to college, now you've got this push-pull. You said, what, philosophy major, and also you wanted to be a musician at the same time?
Yeah, I think I wanted to be, the things I studied in school were things that I didn't know if I was going to make any of my living at. I didn't go to school for that. They were just things I wanted to learn about.
So you're running a safe career as a musician. There you go. I'm sure your parents were pulling their hair out.
So I started to wonder if I could do music. I didn't know anybody who did it for a living, so I kind of started playing at all the college coffee houses and got to meet Dave Fry, who ran Godfrey Daniels, which is the professional coffee house on the south side of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I started going there, and I stuck around there after college because I didn't know of any place like it back home. And a lot of the people, I eventually started to run the open mics and volunteer as a sound man and usher and MC. And eventually I started to become kind of the house opening act for the songwriters coming through. And a lot of the songwriters that I opened shows for opened doors for me in other parts of the country.
Wonderful. There's an interview of yours that I read where you were almost basically living at the Godfrey Daniels Club.
I did live there for a while, kind of between homes. I was living up the street, and the landlord raised the rent, and I didn't think I could afford it. The people at Godfrey Daniels said I could stay in the basement until I found a place. So I was there a couple months. I think it was the summer of 1982.
Really nice. And I guess by helping to run the club and all the different aspects of it, you really learned the ins and outs of live performance.
Well, I got to be very inspired by the performers coming through, and I'd ask them questions and listen to their stories, and I just loved hanging out. I loved the hanging out almost as much as each performer could just transform the room, you know, that they could, it would just seem like an ordinary room. It was a former donut shop that they Dave Fry and Cindy Dinsmore made into a really a great club. And
does it still exist?
It does. It's still there. Oh. It's still hanging in there. It's, you know, it's often a tough go. The neighborhood has changed. It's harder to find places to park. That's been a challenge for them, but it's still a great place.
Now, who were some of the people, John Gorka, that were playing at Godfrey Daniels that at that point you were opening for and eventually sometimes singing with?
Some of the people, there's people that I'd never heard of before who had kind of discovered there. Stan Rogers was one of my musical heroes. I never got to open for him, but I got to MC and I got to hang out when they came through there. Jack Hardy,
somebody
I opened for, and Nancy Griffith, other people I got to meet there, Dave Van Ronk, and Rosalie Sorrells. There's a whole bunch of people.
Well, let's talk a little Van Ronking, shall we? Because he was all in the news a couple of weeks ago with the opening of the movie Llewyn Davis by the Coen brothers. Did you see the movie?
I have not seen it yet, no. I heard of the book, but I've not seen the movie.
Well, the folk community has been all up in arms about the movie, saying that it's all depressing and it didn't really capture the spirit of how wonderful it was and how communal, and how communal you made it sound in that folk era way back when.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and knowing Dave Van Ronk, what were your thoughts on the man?
Oh, he was one of the best people I ever got a chance to meet. I met him through Christine Levin, who was good friends with him, and he knew so much about everything, you know, he especially music, and he was very, very encouraging to that next generation of singer-songwriters, and he wrote the liner notes to my first record.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't want him to do it like a regular kind of liner notes thing, so I encouraged him to write a fictional version of liner notes, and I was very glad to be able to have that happen.
Of course. Oh, my goodness. Did he teach you any guitar? I know Christine Lavin learned some guitar from him.
No, I never got a chance to to study with him. It's kind of funny. For me, guitar playing was only something I just wanted to do to accompany the songs. I didn't really put too much stock in my playing, but as time has gone on, I found that I've learned how to play better than I thought I could. And recently, there's a Stefan Grossman's guitar workshop. There's a video series of Dave Van Ronk teaching several pieces on the guitar, which I've now downloaded on the computer. So I, now, even though he's not with us anymore, I can still take lessons from Dave and learn from him. But he was one of the best people I ever got a chance to meet.
Do you have any anecdotes about him, any amusing memories or unusual memories of him?
I opened for him once at the Speakeasy on McDougal Street, Greenwich Village. I thought it went up okay. There was some commotion at one point, but I didn't really pay attention to it. And apparently, I found out afterwards that during my set, somebody in the audience threw up.
Happens to me in my sermons every Saturday. But yes.
And when Dave heard this, he said, "Everybody's a critic."
Excellent. And what about some other people that you've worked with and memories of them? Do you have any amusing anecdotes of Nancy Griffith?
Oh, Nancy Griffith was, she encouraged me to enter the Kerrville Folk Festival, New Folk. It's like a kind of like a competition of songwriting that was started by Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Of course, yes.
And Nancy encouraged me to enter that, and it turns out that I won.
Ooh.
So that was very a big deal for me, but I'm trying to think. There's probably some anecdotes there, but there was one. I was writing a song called "Prom Night in Pigtown."
Oh, that's on your first or second album, there, yeah?
It was early on, yeah. I think it was on Jax Crow's, or it might have been this. I'm not sure, but somewhere early on there.
Okay.
And originally, it was just a song about a strange, kind of an odd town called Pigtown, and I was at a party with Eric von Schmidt, who's a folk singer from the 60s.
Name checked on Bob Dylan's first album, yes?
Yes. And we were sitting around playing, and he played a song called "Frogs Go to the Movies." working on it, I had a line in it. I'm not going to remember it.
I can try Google.
I remember. Okay, there.
One night in Pigtown. Google lyrics. Let's see. Let's see if I can find this here.
That's what it was. Okay, that was the first line. It was prom night in Pigtown. There were ham bones and long gowns. And originally I had it. It was prom night in Pigtown. There were pork chops in big gowns. And she said, John, the fat girls are going to hate that.
Oh.
I don't know if you could use that one, but...
Good for her. Okay. Is she wanting to keep all your audience and not have half the crowd going, eh, tis. Especially since you were single back then, so, you don't want to ruin your chances with the crowd. Well, let me ask you, I think that's a fair question. Before you met your lovely wife and had the kids and all that, you were a single, good-looking folk singer on the road. Were you out there? Were you getting in various cities having fun?
I was kind of clueless in terms of the social interactions, so I realized later that there were opportunities, but I didn't quite pick up on it in the moment. I guess it probably not very much like a rock and roll story.
You're doing folk, so it is kind of different. And you do seem, and a lot of things I've read about you, that you're much more reserved and shy and quiet in person. And then, do you feel like you become a different person on stage?
I think on stage I'm closer to the person I would like to be off stage. But off stage, I don't get a chance to sing that much, and I feel like I can express myself the way I want to, singing the songs I write on stage. So I was never all that happy with the way I communicated off stage as I'm demonstrating right
now. you're fine, but you do have a halting sort of delivery. So you seem like someone who kind of wants to fade into the background a lot or stare at your shoes, but then boom, the microphone's there, the light kicks
then
on.
On stage I've come to sort of come to terms with my awkwardness.
Good.
And I have more fun performing now than I did when I was starting out. I was always drawn to it, but never all that comfortable doing it.
Did you or do you deal with stage fright?
Oh, yeah. I always get nervous before I play. If I have an idea what song I'll start out with, I'm generally less so. But it's always a kind of a battle of nerves.
You go out there without a song list?
Right. Yeah, I tell the audience I write up the song list. I have a set list for every night, but I don't write it up until after the show. I like to have the order, but I don't feel like I can presume to know which songs to play for an audience I haven't met yet.
Wow, but that's easy to do if you're going acoustic. What if you have backing people?
Generally, that would be very difficult to do if I had other people playing with me, but most of the time I play by myself, so I can get away with that.
I wasn't just kidding. I mean, you played with a symphony orchestra. One time you did a concert.
Then I had to have a set list. And
yeah, okay.
I had to really...
You can't just go with a tuba player. Hey, wing it!
Right. Yeah, take it.
Number 413, go! Yeah. No, you can't.
Hi, this is John Gorka, and you're listening to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Now, you told the Huffington Post, we're quoting them again, but this is you being quoted, I have always felt it was better to really strongly affect a small number of people than to reach a big number of people only superficially or temporarily. So does this mean you could play somewhat bigger clubs than you are, but you really prefer the subcultures, the little places like that?
I don't know
how many subculture has, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that... I'm not sure if I could reach a larger audience if I change what I do. I feel like... if I did that, I'd end up doing something that wasn't as good as what I'm doing now. I'm not sure if I'm making... That's not being too clear there. I feel like it would be nice to reach, be universally appreciated, but mainly I feel like I have to do what I think is the best I can do and then try to find an audience that would like that. There's this one time I was at the airport and I was checking my instrument and my bags at the check-in person. And she said, John Gorka, should I know your music? And I said, I think everybody should know my music. And it would be nice to have universally adoring crowds, but I'm fine with the kind of the places I play. I like, that's the thing I learned about it at Godfrey Daniels, you can make magic in any place if you've got, you know, it doesn't have to be a huge palace. If you've got the bare minimum of good sound and good lights and, and an audience that's willing to listen, then you can really make magic.
You're on this tier of peers of people like Lucy Kaplansky and Christine Lavin and maybe David Bromberg and people who are well-known and have crowds, but at the same time you were coming up in a period, maybe a little afterwards, where they had folks like Suzanne Vega and Tracy Chapman, who were, for better or worse, vaulted into this bigger crowd level. Was there ever a point when you were looking at binoculars at them and going, ooh?
Oh, no. I mean, I think I felt that their success helped me.
Mm.
I know that when Tracy Chapman's record became a big deal, that's when Will Ackerman at Windham Hill Records said that there must be more of this out there, and I'd like to find it. And so I think her success and the success of Nancy Griffith and Suzanne Vega.
Right, yes.
Reaching a bigger audience.
Sean Colvin, right, yeah.
Yeah, and Sean Colvin a little bit later, yeah. Really helped me, so I don't feel like, why not me?
A high tide floats all boats.
Yeah.
Or in our case, it drowns Egyptians, but that's just my people. But, biblical reference. Now, let me ask John Gorka, who is, I'm reminding people, playing this Thursday at Subculture at 45 Bleecker. You can find out more about that at subculturenewyork.com, and that's spelling all those words out. Also, he's got a new CD called Bright Side Down.
Bright Side of Down,
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Forgive me. I was thinking about peanut butter sandwich that always falls down the wrong way. You're back with Red House Records, which is a lovely group of people. I dealt with them when we had Lucy Kaplansky on the show. But you were with Windham Hill, and it's funny, you wouldn't think that Windham Hill would be this commercial entity that would be putting people square pegs into round holes. And yet you weren't as comfortable there as you are with Red House.
Well, I did my first record with Red House and then moved to Windham Hill. You know, they were a bigger company with more resources and major label distribution and everything, and it started out great and ended not so great, but in the end, the good they did, they couldn't undo. I wasn't sure if I wanted to work with any record company after that, and Bob Feldman from Red House convinced me they could do a better job than I could myself, and that's the truth. It's still the truth today, and I'm glad I get a chance to work with a team of people who are really good at what they do.
Well, without naming names, you don't have to do anything like that, but what went wrong at Windham Hill?
Well, it's the people who brought me in either left or were fired, so I was kind of left in the hands of people I didn't know. So it was not a good situation. I mean, that's a pretty common story in the music business, and I had a little bit of trouble, but it did no lasting damage.
Thank God, yeah. And then you put out some lovely records with Windham Hill. It's not as if they suddenly made you new kids on the block or...
They let me be me. And, you know, they were trying to sell me in other ways. And I know I didn't really care about so much about the marketing as long as I could make the music and discover the music that was in me.
That's important indeed. So when you're doing concerts and things like that, and you've done with them. As you said, after the show's over, that's when you drop the set list of what you played. But you get through a show. Do you dwell on the bad stuff, the broken strings? If there's a drunk person, do you dwell on the great transcendent moments? What's the after effect for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Most of the time, I think about the things that didn't go as I hoped they would have gone. While the show is going on, I try to be as in the moment as possible. But afterwards, I kind of review the things that go wrong. But then after that, then I start thinking about the songs that I played and the sequence and thinking, okay, that wasn't too bad.
Well, you told the Dave Van Ronk vomit story. What's the worst or weirdest thing that ever happened to you in a concert?
Oh, I probably blocked it out.
Ha!
I'm sure that there's worse things. A couple of people have collapsed lately.
Oh, lately? This, oh.
So,
Do you hit a certain frequency in one of your songs?
I don't know, but that's, I don't know if that says what that says about the music or the audience, but that's happened, and everybody was fine, I think.
What about an unexpected, fun, or amazing thing, surprise, that happened in a concert?
Somebody in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, wrote to me ahead of time and said that he wanted to propose to his girlfriend during the show because my music had meant a lot to them. So at the end of my first set, I said, I think this guy, is there any questions out there? I think there's a guy, Dave, who's got a question. And then I could see in the back him getting down on a knee and proposing to his girlfriend. I think she said yes. And
I would hope so. Otherwise, that'd be a real downer for the concert right there.
That's not really all that dramatic, I think, but you know, kind of a big deal for them.
Well, sure. But speaking of songs having different meanings for different people or being meaningful, there's one song that you did. There's a story you tell, and I would love for you to tell again, where you have an idea in mind for a song, you write it, and it means a certain thing to you, and that's what it is. The song I'm talking about in this particular case is I Saw a Woman with Your Hair.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was one song I remember. Some of the songs, people tell me about what the song means to them, and it expands my idea of what the song is, and it makes it easier to sing a song for a long time. In the case of that song, but I remember I was in Utah, probably Salt Lake, and somebody came up to me and they said, "There's a song called I Saw a Stranger with Your Hair," and she said, "It's a song that when she hears that song, she thinks of her son, who had passed on," and I was thinking of it as of the person I was writing the song for, but I hadn't thought of it in that way. But that's a perfectly valid interpretation, but not one I had anticipated.
And have you had other occasions where your songs, somebody told you, oh, this made me think of so-and-so, and you just were like, oh, wow, no.
Yeah, that happens quite a bit. And so that, you know, it's kind of a sobering thing when you realize that it could have that kind of a meaning and that kind of effect. So it's it makes the songs for me more like a common ground or a kind of a community property that I can meet the audience, and that's kind of gotten larger as there's more and more songs out there.
And as far as the genesis of some songs, for example, you have the wife, you have the kids, you're heterosexual, and yet you wrote a song about having a dream about Judy Garland.
Oh, right.
Now, let me ask, did you actually have a dream about Judy Garland and then write a song about it, or did you think, hey, I want to write a song as if I had a dream about Judy Garland?
No, I remember I was going down to Houston to play at a place called Anderson Fair, and I had a biography of Judy Garland that I was reading on the plane on the way down, and I mean, I always liked her as a kid growing up, from The Wizard of Oz mainly, and, you know, and some, from some of the other movies, but I didn't really know anything about her life, and that was kind of what she went through was kind of a shock, so I wanted to put that into a song. Hi, this is John Gorka, and you're listening to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
You have this new album out. It's called Bright Side of Down. Is there a theme to it? Are the songs connected in any way, or they just come to you and you try and arrange them?
I've recorded more songs than I put on the record. There seems to be a fair bit of winter and a little bit of springtime in there, longing for spring. I live in Minnesota now, so winter's kind of a big deal here.
Yeah, let me ask you that. You grew up in Pennsylvania, right?
I grew up in New Jersey.
New Jersey. And then
I grew up in New Jersey, and then I lived in Pennsylvania. Went to school in Pennsylvania, and lived there for almost 20 years.
And you get to travel and this, and as you said, your wife takes care of the kids. She's a freelance writer. Why the hell are you living in Minnesota?
Well, she's from Minnesota, so I just need to be kind of near an airport if I to do what I do. She's got family here, and
I know, but Miami has an airport. Santa Cruz has an airport.
That's true, but that's not as centrally located as Minnesota.
And you don't want to be in Chicago because you'd never leave.
Right.
You'd just be in the airport.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. Okay, by the way, we're talking with John Gorka, Red House Records recording artist. Let me ask you a question. You've probably been asked this before, but have you had two or three of your own songs to take to a desert island and two or three of songs by somebody else? What would they be?
Let's see. I think somebody else's songs I'd probably take. I probably wouldn't listen to myself because I could play those songs if I needed to.
That's true.
But other people's songs, Townes Van Zandt's Poncho and Lefty is one of my all-time favorites. Also, Michael Smith's song, The Dutchman. Those are a couple of songs that have kind of expanded my idea of what a song could be.
Did you know either of them? Did you ever meet Townes Van Zandt?
I did. I met him a few times. One of the last times, they were having a night of his music at a place called La Zona Rosa in Austin. And he was there. I got to meet him afterwards, and I introduced myself. Because I never know if people will remember, so I'd tell my name and stuff. And he said, "We've met before. I never forget a nose."
Oh, wow. Yeah, you know, if he'd said that to me, I probably would have punched him. It's an ethnic thing there, but okay, that's all right. Was he in okay shape?
Oh, yeah, he's super sweet and in good form.
Good. Do you have any favorite cover versions of your songs? People who have done your tunes?
Maura O'Connell does a beautiful version of my song Blue Chalk. That's one. I love what Lucy Kaplansky and Eliza Gilkison did with my songs on Red Horse.
Nice.
I made with them in 2010. That's what comes to mind at the moment.
Have you ever written a song specifically for someone else or with someone else's voice in mind?
I know I've written things for specific situations. I'm trying to think if I ever wrote anything for... I don't think I've ever written a song specifically for anyone else. Sometimes while I'm writing the song, I think of a person's voice and how those lyrics would sound coming out of their voice to see if it seems like a real song.
Do you have a specific example of a song that you did that way?
There's a song on the Red Horse record called If These Walls Could Talk, and the last few lines, see if I can remember how that goes. If the world were slate and your life were chalk, I would speak of dust if these walls could talk. And I thought about Townes Van Zandt. How would that sound? How would those lines sound coming out of his mouth and his voice as he might sing them?
Let me also ask John Gorka, with the whole sea change in the way that records are made and distributed, you have a home studio. Is that where you do the brunt of the recording for the Red House Records for your new CD?
I can do some of it here. I've got good equipment, and I can do some of the recording here, depending on the songs. But I'd say most of it I did in a studio in Minneapolis. We have a kind of a similar setup at both places, so that if I can have the same mic preamp and bring the vocal mic back and forth, so I can do stuff at both places and have it work. So that's kind of fun. I'm kind of a geek. I love the technology. I even built the computer that we mixed the record on.
Whoa!
That's pretty geek-like.
Speaking of geek stuff, do you have other hobbies that are not musical?
I ride bicycle. I'm looking forward to that when the snow finally melts.
Well, in Minnesota, that could be August.
Yeah, we had snow until early May last year. It was kind of an endless winter.
And what about, besides riding bikes, what else?
Music history, I'm interested in reading about. Those are my main things. I like sound, I like recording, but those are my main interests, I guess.
And also you do somewhere between 100 and 150 concerts per year, so that does keep you on the road and busy. And
quite a few, yeah.
And is it true, I think I read somewhere that you said this, and most are, not all, but a lot of the artists in your situation say this, that really the career is in the live performance, the concerts, and the CDs are almost like extra?
Right, yeah, it's almost, and more and more as people unfortunately want to get their music for free, there's less income from that. Fortunately, people will buy CDs at shows, which really helps a lot. The streaming and the general downloading for free has hit the income from royalties quite a bit. I think it also works in a way that enables people to discover my music that who would not have discovered it before. So I don't think it's all that bad, but that means the main income is from...
It has to be from seeing you in person.
Live shows, yeah.
And hopefully this is true because we want people to come down to Subculture this Thursday to see you. After the show, do you sign CDs? Do you
yeah.
sell? Oh, yes, good.
Sign my name. I can sign just about anybody's name.
Sign mine, but it has to be in Hebrew.
Okay. That was kind of a joke I was trying to...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll set you up again. I hate when I ruin somebody else's joke.
Oh, no, it's okay. It was probably not that good of a joke, so...
Oh, well, forgive me.
Sign my name. I can sign, you know, just about anybody's name, because, you know, I could... Abraham Lincoln, you know, I have a sports memorabilia business, too, so...
Oh. That was the joke. Okay, wait, I'll...
Throw that out.
There we go. I've got a laugh machine handy for cases like that. We tried. Well, forgive me for stepping on your punchline, John Gorka,
that's
but
right.
Everybody, step to Subculture this Thursday. There's more information at subculturenewyork.com. Also, don't forget, you can go to johngorka.com, and of course, it's G-O-R-K-A, johngorka.com. To find out what you're doing, where you're going to be, and buy your CDs online. I think they're autographed there, too.
Yeah, they're only... You can't get a copy that's not marked up by me.
Wow.
You only get signed copies.
And you don't gouge. I think they're reasonable CD prices, and you get the autograph on top of it for free, which is lovely.
Yeah.
I think that you know, being a Jew, this appeals to my economy, if you know what I'm saying. I don't even know what I'm saying. John Gorka, do you have any words of advice? Last words here from John Gorka for people in this day and age, 2014, who want to start writing songs, making music, and even having a career, a life of it.
My general philosophy is high standards, low overhead, and realistic expectations. So,
are you sure you're not Jewish? The late Susie Rotolo,
who's on the cover of Bob Dylan's
second album, yes,
Free Will album. Her book about Greenwich Village was a great one, I thought. And one of the things she said, the difference between then and now is, back then we had something to say, not something to sell. So I think if, before you have something to sell, make sure you have something to say.
That's lovely. That's a perfect outro here. For John Gorka, who is selling CDs, who is selling live performances, but also has a lot to say, and you can hear that on his 11, 12 albums that he's got out. Go to his website, go to his shows, and all I can do is wish you much, much more creativity, success, good health, even though you're in Minnesota, and good things. Thank you so much, John Gorka.
Oh, thank you, Rabbi.
Shalom.
Shalom.